You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2022 Giro d'Italia, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Today we are in Treviso.
Cozze ci tene, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora. Cozze ci tene, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Tecnicamente noi siamo un po' tra dei fuochi, perché Aperol nasce a Padova, sì. Select nasce a Venezia.
Sì, però il giro si vede più Aperol.
Sì, direi. Sì, perché Aperol è, diciamo, quello che è stato sdoganato prima, è quello più celebre.
Sì.
Tutto qui, dopo.
We need to debrief the riders, but that said, you know, and obviously today you made a rookie mistake, let's say.
Well, Brian, before I ask, where are we, Brian? We heard there from a team manager and were threatening to pull someone's ears, as they say in Italian, give someone a bit of a tirata delle orecchie, one of his riders. Do you know who it was, Brian?
The rider or the team manager?
The team manager, someone you know well.
I don't think it's actually someone that I hired originally. It must be Luca Guaccilena.
It was of Trek Segafredo. Actually, Luca was being a bit more diplomatic. And talking of diplomacy, well, we might need a diplomat to settle several issues tonight. One is, what is the real spritz? We're in Treviso, a place where spritz is often drunk. And we heard also from our waiter here this evening bringing us a select spritz. Now, this is the mythical select spritz we've been talking about on the podcast for several years, and this is the original, really, and best. Well, the Venetians would certainly say best, invented in Venice. But our waiter there was talking about the conflict between Aperol spritz invented in Padova, select spritz invented here in, sorry, not invented here, invented in Venice. Treviso is kind of in between.
Yeah, stuck in the middle, isn't it?
And, well, that's one sort of gastronomic conflict that we're going to talk about tonight. The other one involves a dessert. When I say that we're in Treviso, some people might already guess what we're talking about. Anyway, to resolve all of this strife, all of this conflict, including the daily strife there is between you and me, we've called on the acting ambassador of the United States, Thomas Smith, who is an old friend of the podcast, or an old friend in the sense that we met you, Tom, last year in Cittadella, not far from here, and you've dropped in on the Giro again, and it's an absolute, well, delight and a privilege to have you here, and you're also enjoying a lovely select. What's the verdict on that, first of all?
Well, Daniel, thank you very much, and Brian, very nice to meet you. I'm a big supporter of the select because it's in between the Aperol and the Campari in the bittersweet spectrum. So I'm a big supporter and often wind up with a select when I'm in Treviso or Vicenza, this area. So
it's also, chaps, bright red. It's the color of Campari. That could bring us to another spritz that's drunk in Milan, but I've had an idea, and, well, this might be completely misguided, it's probably misguided, to start importing Select to the United Kingdom. Do you think that I could make my fortune by doing that? Because Aperol has really taken off in the United Kingdom, but
I think that's an excellent idea, because it
apart from the fact I don't live in the United Kingdom.
There is that. But I think because of everything is about origin, you know, originality, like something being original, something, you know, a sense of place, which I think, especially in Italy, but also elsewhere, I think that's really what Italy imports or exports. It's the sense of something being from a specific place. And so I think you could make millions here, Daniel.
About 5 minutes have gone already in the podcast. 3 minutes, 6 seconds, and we haven't mentioned cycling yet. Chaps, we're going to have to get onto that in a minute. But Brian, first I would like you to describe in forensic detail the scene, where we are.
So we're in Piazza Ancelotto in... you can't really say that Treviso is underestimated, but it's every time I come here, I realize what a lovely place it is, and this place that we should really visit more often, even if there wasn't a bike race on. There's such a nice atmosphere here, friendly people, quite relaxed for Northern Italy. I like the accent. It's one of the accents that you do best.
I heard a lot of... Today we were talking about the mannerism, the sort of affectation, you could say, that certain people have of saying listen always in conversation, look, look,
yeah,
look.
Yeah.
We always make always laugh at, very good-naturedly, Matt White, who always, and Australians in general, who always say, look at the start of every sentence. Today I just kept hearing guarda, 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 which is sort of a Venetian dialect for look.
And I would probably slightly prefer that dialect to the one, if now that we're talking about the great divide between types of Aperol, I probably prefer that to the Padovan accent.
Brian, it's time to talk about cycling with Tom first, because he was our on-course reporter. As well as being our diplomat, our ambassador in residence for this evening's podcast, we sent him out on the course today in a car ahead of the race, and well, we expected a full debriefing, again, a very forensic synthesis of what happened.
We've been a bit nervous about the tale of the tapper.
We've been struggling with the tale of the tapper, so we've enlisted you, Tom. What can you tell us about your day with your wife out there ahead of the race?
I was hoping that you guys would do the tale of the tapper, and then I could just come in with a couple of comments. Here's what happened today. Four riders got away, and they stayed away. And one of them won, and then the bunch was split behind and came in pieces. There you go. There's my tale of the tapper for you today.
A fantastic non-political tale of the tapper. But more generally, before we do get to the official tale of the tapper, which tonight has been palmed off, delegated to Lionel, who's back in not Watford, how was your day generally on the roads of Val d'Obbiadene and Prosecco and the Veneto?
So this is the second time that I've gone within the race. Last time I went to on a mountain stage. What was beautiful about this is you're going through the wine region of Italy, or, you know, the Prosecco region. Brian can correct me on all the wine references I'm about to make. But it was a beautiful stage. It was surprisingly interesting because there were these little hills that were full of people along the course. And so, although it was flat and even sort of slightly downhill all the way, there were these three points where it was like really interesting to see, well, the race, but also the people along the side of the road. So, atmospherically great. Also, weather's perfect. And, you know, nice to see a flat stage. And also, frankly, for the competition side of me, it's nice to see the breakaway staying away for the whole day. So, it was pretty exciting from that perspective.
Well, we heard about a rookie mistake in the intro to tonight's episode from Luca Guercilena. He wasn't the one who made the rookie mistake, but he was referring to one. It wasn't the rookie mistake that some would argue the peloton made of letting the brake go away. It was another one, but we'll hear more about that later. As I said, we have enlisted Lionel tonight. Been a busy few days, hasn't it, Brian? We're getting to the end of the Giro. And I think, Lionel was keen to get involved again. So we're going to go almost live to Not Watford for the Tale of the Tapper.
Well, 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 here I am back on Tale of the Tapper duty, and the Giro d'Italia is beautifully poised, isn't it? Two big mountain stages and the final time trial to go, and Richard Carapaz and Jai Hindley are still separated by just those 3 seconds. But I'm sure everyone in Australia, and Jai Hindley fans everywhere for that matter, must have had their hearts in their mouths during the run-in when they saw their man off the back of the peloton and wondered what on earth was going on. Fortunately for the Bora Hansgrohe rider, it was a puncture inside the final 3 kilometres. And so even though he finished behind the Carapaz group, he was given the same time and doesn't lose ground overall. The same can't be said for João Almeida, because his Giro was curtailed this morning. The Portuguese rider was lying fourth overall, but tested positive for COVID and had to pull out of the race. The stage itself was a curious affair, 156 kilometres to Treviso. We've had the food stage, we've had the wine stage, this was the tiramisu stage. There was a 4-man breakaway that was never given much breathing space, and yet the peloton failed to reel them in before the line. On the face of it, it looked to be the classic doomed break. Dries de Bont of Alpecin Fenix, Davide Gaburo of Bardiani, Magnus Cort of EF Education Easy Post, and Eduardo Affini of Jumbo Visma. The lead didn't even reach 3 minutes. And with Quickstep and Groupama riding on the front, a sprint finish seemed inevitable. But as they came into the final couple of kilometres, it began to look like they were going to stay away from the peloton. Magnus Cort went to the front right before the start of the sprint, and then it was de Bont versus Affini, and the Belgian Alpecin Fenix rider got it on the line. their third stage winner of this race after Mathieu van der Poel and Stefano Oldani, of course. The other Oldani, Arno Demar, is well clear in the points competition and just has to survive the mountains to win the Ciclamino jersey now. Easier said than done, given the profile of the next two stages. Likewise, Koen Bouwman is well clear in the King of the Mountains competition. But there's a new best young rider after Almeida's withdrawal. Juan Pedro Lopez, who led the race overall for so long, of course, will be in the white jersey tomorrow. So here we go then. 3 seconds, barely time to blink. Two uphill finishes to come. And the questions are, can Hindley gain the time he needs? Will Carapaz stretch clear, or will it all go down to the final time trial on Sunday? As you know, I don't do speculation, so we'll just have to see what happens.
Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success. The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, our title sponsors. And since I've got home, I've been back on my bike and I've been wearing the Super Sapiens sensor to go through another period of learning about how my blood glucose levels change, particularly now that I'm doing a bit more exercise. So I'm monitoring what a bike ride does to my blood glucose levels, how my blood glucose responds after exercise, before and after I eat, and I'm just gathering data really, and I'm going to hand that data over to Cristina Scrocia of the University of Verona to see what I can learn about my energy levels and whether there's anything I can do when it comes to my fueling that might nudge my performance up a level or two. If you want to find out more about Super Sapiens, go to supersapiens.com. Now back to Daniel and Brian in Italy.
Well, Brian, Lionel did extremely well to identify the winner of the stage. Dries De Bont, very popular winner, 30-year-old from Bornem, the Antwerp province of Belgium. Very popular because, well, it hasn't really escaped anyone's attention here at the Giro that he's one of the most available, affable, sort of keen to sign autographs.
Big potential candidate for the Pedaleur du Charme.
He is, and he's also quite a distinctive rider on the bike. He's quite stylish, isn't he? He wears these long white socks, much like Mathieu van der Poel, his teammate. And he's very expressive as well. In this age, we've talked before about, you know, in the age of compulsory helmets, which is obviously a necessary and good thing, but it's sometimes harder to get a sense of someone's personality when they're on the bike. Dries De Bont is someone who gives you a sort of quite a visceral sense of who he is and what he's about as a bike rider.
And that's what we want out of the sport. You know, it's not. I think cycling fans are often drawn into it because of big personalities. And unlike soccer, for instance, where they support a team through the ups and downs, and unless they have like Velcro on their membership card, as you might have for Arsenal, that they identify with riders, not teams. And he's someone that I think would draw a lot of people into cycling because he's a very likable person.
It was really interesting what he said about the breakaway itself in his press conference this evening. I mean, obviously, it was this strange scenario whereby I suppose everyone had today marked down as a sprint. Inevitably, the sprint teams, Cavendish's team, Demar's team, were going to control things. And, well, we expected the break to be reeled back in. But then when you see guys like Eduardo Affini, who's a guy who's not won very much, but he's a big ruler, and I think everyone in the peloton knows that as soon as a guy like that is in the break, there's danger. So alarm bells will start ringing there. They'll start ringing a little bit louder when they see Magnus Kort in there, De Bont as well, and then Gaburo, who was strong on the stage to Naples. So already that was a slight change from some of the breakaways we've seen earlier in the race. And then the fact that we're in the third week and resources are dwindling in the sprint teams, and just generally everyone's getting a little bit more tired and maybe a little bit less motivated in some cases.
And history really says that the last sprinter stage, now that the Giro finishes with the time trial, history really dictates that the breakaway stays away. So there was a sense of, I think they underestimated once again that those riders seeking out that breakaway do it because they know it's possible.
Yeah, and the break, well, the gap did come down, and they were almost within touching distance. They were almost within a minute. It looked as though that would happen, this classic scenario of the brake being reeled in. But in fact, then it started to go out again. And it was difficult to know what had happened at that point, whether it was the guys in front who had suddenly stepped on the accelerator or the peloton who had maybe become a little complacent. And this is where I come to De Bont's comments in the press conference this evening. He talked about breakaways and the art of getting into breakaways and winning from a breakaway as being like a game of poker, a bluff game. He said, you have to make them believe they have it under control. At the same time, the peloton tries to make the break believe that the break has it under control, when actually that's not the case. And it's rare that we get a scenario like we did today, but it does sometimes happen. And often it's due to factors beyond the control of the riders in front. The other thing today that complicated matters for the breakaway was this climb, the Muro del Cadel Poggio, which caused an acceleration in the main bunch when they were on their way into the climb. But then after that, inevitably, there was a little bit of a sort of consolidation, a little bit of a slowing down maybe.
Yeah, the breakaway negotiated it at a steady pace, but there was positioning in the main group, because all the GC guys, they need to be at the front. They're all in Matol, they use resources to get up there, and once they're passed, they let up a little bit. And that could easily have been the 5-10 seconds that meant that the breakaway was successful.
I said it would be a very popular victory. De Bont would be a very popular winner today. He was in exuberant form in his press conference, as he always is in interviews. He's one of the riders who tends to linger longest after stage finishes giving interviews. He said that throughout his career he's been inspired by a quote he once saw from another Belgian rider, Oliver Naarssen. He says Naarssen had once said, you have to fight with your heroes until they become rivals. And he said that this has sort of provided motivation and inspiration throughout his career. And indeed, Naarssen is now one of his rivals. He's a huge Tom Boonen fan as well. He's from very close to where Tom Boonen grew up and raced. And of course, now he is, well, he's in this Alpecin Phoenix team, which is really developing, growing, getting stronger with every race, it seems. And he's never going to be a prolific winner with the characteristics that he has, but he has this role of being able to get in breakaways, trying to win stages in the fashion that he won today. But then he's also a valuable domestique for like the likes of Mathieu van der Poel and Tim Merlier.
It would have been a historic win if Danish Magnus Cort had pulled it off, which he was pretty far from doing, because he would have been only the second Danish rider to have won a stage in all of the three Grand Tours. And it's almost 30 years have passed since that happened the last time, well, 29. And what rider would that be, Daniel, that some 30 years ago finished that coup of winning a stage in each Grand Tour?
Rolf Sørensen?
Nope.
Well, it wasn't Brian Nygaard, I don't know that.
No.
I mean, Bjarne Riis? No, I doubt it.
Jesper Skibby.
Jesper Skibby, really? Wow. He stuffed up the sprint, though, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
He stuffed it up in the sense that my impression was that they were preoccupied with the peloton coming from behind. The peloton got within, well, with a kilometre to go, it was about 15 seconds, wasn't
it?
Yeah,
and then Cort went to the front early. I think you and I talked about that before we started doing the podcast here tonight, that he pushed a little bit to make sure that they had that gap, and then he wanted to establish his sprint on top of that. And I think he tried to do too much. And as you said also initially, he was one of the big engines in the breakaway.
The rider who was just edged out of the finish line was the Italian Eduardo Affini, and I spoke to him shortly after the finish today.
Eduardo, if we looked at your power file for today, would it be pretty constant? Because the gap went up and down and up and down.
Yeah, the first part, I would say, really high power to make the break, to get the gap. And then, we together we decided to take it easily and gamble a little bit with the bands to see what they were going to do. And just before the Fontolo climb, we decided to speed up and try to gain time. actually the plan worked out pretty well. And then we went always all together with a good working together with the same goal, try to win the stage. And unfortunately I found Dries faster than me, but yeah, chapeau to him.
When you saw Magnus Cort leading out the sprint with 500 or so to go, did you think that's perfect? Because at least I can come off his wheel.
Yeah. As I said before, I'm not really fast. Especially, I'm not really explosive in taking up speed. So I need a long sprint. And it was perfect to have coordination in front of me and trying to get a bit of slipstream. And then... just follow my instinct, and I decided to go at one point, and I think it was half a wheel faster.
Margo! Which was the last sprint you did?
Bravo! I think in Norway, maybe the one I won in Norway in 2019. So yeah, it's been a long time apart from training here.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you about our collaboration with Matt. Much more about this to come in the next few weeks, and especially during the Tour de France, but you don't have to be a genius to work out that our collaboration will include an item or two of clothing, and perhaps some other accessories too. Looking forward to unveiling that during the Tour de France. In the meantime, we've been finding out about MAP, the company, and recently we spoke to one of the founders, Jared Smith. Now, the word MAP, M-A-A-P, in capital letters, gives the impression that it's an acronym. So what does it stand for? How did the founders, Jared and Ollie, come up with the name? What does it mean? This is Jared Smith to explain all.
I remember back in the early days, Ollie and I were bouncing names back and forth, and we both wanted something quite short and punchy so it could be part of the graphic element of the brand. And it actually was M-A-double-P, and because I'd seen it on a, actually just seen it written on a box at work, and it was an abbreviation. And once we both liked the word, I was like, oh, well, it could mean Melbourne Apparel. We're from Melbourne and it's a great design scene. But it was mainly just we loved the look of the word. And as it turned out, we couldn't use that word because it was unavailable. So we swapped out the P for an A, and then we were just sold on it. It kind of looked like a couple of mountains, the double A. So it is pronounced MAP, for everyone that's wondering. We quite often get asked that question. And now we refer to it as merging aesthetics and performance. But it has derived from Melbourne, and we're very passionate about where we come from and proud to be Melbourne, proud to be Australian, and that's where it actually started.
MAP have just released their Axis range. It's really, really striking. Have a look at map.cc and you'll know what I'm talking about. And, well, that might offer a little hint as to what's to come in the collaboration with the Cycling Podcast.
Well, Brian, an interesting day at the front of the race, as has been the case often at this Giro d'Italia. But today, it was also pretty interesting behind, in a way that we didn't really expect, because there was a small climb on the route, a famous climb and an illustrious climb, certainly in the Veneto, the Muro del Poggio, twinned with the Mur van Gerardsbergen in Belgium, twinned with Mur de Bretagne in Brittany as well, as of 2018, I think. But it caused some damage. It caused some damage in the white jersey competition and in the race, I suppose, for the top 10, because Juanpe Lopez lost a significant amount of time. Brian, he came in 72nd place, 2 minutes and 57 down on the stage winner, after a pretty frenetic pursuit by his Trek Segafredo team, and a futile pursuit in the sense that, well, they certainly didn't get back to the peloton.
Well, I remember you said to me this morning when we got in the car, today's an easy day, so don't let your guard down, because that's really when shit happens. And you could definitely say that that was the case for Trek Segafredo. It was a really bad day for them. It's been a good Giro, you know, winning stages and having had the jersey for so long. But I'm sure they would agree, they let themselves down today. And I think it was referred to as a rookie mistake.
It was by Luca Guercilena. Do you know there's a film that's been made about the Muro del Cadelpoggio by the director for many, many years of Rise cycling coverage? Do you know what the title of the film is? It's about, well, it's about life in general in that part of the Veneto. And the title of the film is I Don't Know How It Happened, But It Happened. And that pretty much sums up Luca Guercilena's thoughts after the finish. Here he is.
Well, Luca, a difficult day for you guys and, well, problems we didn't expect. We didn't expect GC riders to be out the back on the Muro del Cadelpoggio. Did it surprise you, or were you prepared? Were you guys prepared for it?
Oh, well, in the meeting this morning, we said exactly to be very attentive on the plateau and suddenly on the downhill. But, you know, we are in the third week with a young guy that has not a lot of experience. And despite having a team around him, he was not really able to hold on the position. And when the split up happened, then obviously we have to chase. And, you know, when you have six teams pulling in front for the sprint, it's not easy to don't lose ground. But so far we have done a great Giro, so we need to accept that today was not our day.
And are you more upset, Luca, about the situation on the white jersey, or are you looking more at general classification and the final position there?
Well, we need to check. I think for white jersey, we are okay.
You're still 5 minutes
and
ahead.
Obviously, I don't think even for GC that's a big deal, but clearly, when you set up a strategy, you want that the strategy happen, and if it's not happening because you're not well positioned, then that is what's annoying us. And we'll be very clear with the riders.
When you say be attentive, be in the right position, in your eyes, in your thoughts, what does that mean? Does it mean top 40, top 20?
I mean, when you see that there's six teams pulling, obviously we are not in contention for the sprint, but it means that you need to be at least in the first 60 riders, right? Because that's where you need to be. And we need to debrief the riders, but as said, you know, Juanpe did already a great Giro, and obviously today he made a rookie mistake, let's say.
Well, Brian, I witnessed quite some consternation. I mean, we've got Tom here, who is a practice diplomat, the ambassador, the acting ambassador for the United States to Italy. I think Luca has been pretty diplomatic with me there because I think they were pretty angry tonight with precisely, well, what he alluded to there. The positioning was the issue. You know, it wasn't good enough to be in 50th place or 60th place. They had to be right in the arrowhead of the peloton. Now, this got me thinking, Brian, you have a long and, you know, I suppose, quite successful history and working for teams.
Thank you, Daniel.
Various teams in various roles. I wondered whether you had ever come across, worked with, witnessed team managers who had quite an authoritarian approach and in a scenario like this would have, as we said in the opening to this episode, pulled a few riders' ears tonight.
Well, I can't remember having witnessed, thank God, physical violence, but frustration.
That's not what I was saying.
Well, you know,
Do voices get raised on a regular basis?
Of course they do. Of course, and I think they should also. You know, you have bike riders who struggle to, you know, sometimes interpret situations. It's the last week of a Grand Tour, and as you said this morning, you shouldn't put your guard down. But sometimes mistakes are being made. And often it's the riders who raise their voice, especially after a stage, you know, at this point in the race. And it can be, you know, approached in different ways. Sometimes they kind of need to let off steam, throw some things around, hopefully not too often the bike. It could be a helmet, it could be something else. And that sometimes helps. I've seen those situations being interpreted differently from different types of management. But sometimes it's also important that the management let the riders know, and I'm sure they do, that some, like, a situation wasn't done well enough.
How can that happen? What happened today? We know, and we've lamented the fact, mainly for selfish reasons, because it leaves us waiting to do interviews for longer, but we've talked about the fact for several years that the briefings now in the team buses before stages are long and are forensic and are fastidious, and they watch videos, they go on Google Earth, and there was only one real critical point on today's stage. So that message would have been communicated, it would have been re-emphasized, and yet it still wasn't, I suppose, respected, heeded by Juanpe Lopez. How does that happen?
Well, first of all, I agree that it's not complex. You know, there's no riddle to figuring out what to do at a certain given point of a bike race. But this is the Giro, and it's been a hard Giro. It's been a warm Giro. The riders are tired. And sometimes it there's a domino effect. If one bad judgment has been made or one bad call, and all of a sudden you miss a wheel. And it's there's a reason why they keep in a very repetitive way saying, this is the third week, it might look like an easy stage, this is exactly now that you really need to be careful. Because if you make mistakes on a fast stage like today, especially with the chasing that was going on, you will end up losing more time than you would on a very, very difficult climb, as we saw today with Lopez. So the frustration is justified, and it just takes so little. You know, when it's racing is on like this in this type of stage, you make one mistake, and before you basically look over your shoulder, you're in a position where you really can't claw your way back.
And 150, 160 riders, I'm not sure how many are still in the race, but they also all get the same message and the same briefing, essentially.
Yeah. It's what we often... There's a reason why sometimes you see GC guys get caught out in a crosswind. They know there's a crosswind. They know, you know, they have all the, you know, the recon has been done. There's people in front of the race telling them exactly where it is. But there's a reason why it still happens. It's because some riders are also better at maneuvering in the peloton, and they know exactly that they need to be alert on stages like this.
Brian, it wasn't the only change on general classification, because this morning João Almeida dropped out of the Giro d'Italia. He was in fourth place overall, and well, he had tested positive for COVID. I spoke to his director sportif, Fabio Maldato, this morning in Borgo Valsugana.
Well, Fabio, some really bad news for your team this morning. Just tell us when you found out and how you found out that João had tested positive.
I found out when the doctor sent a message in our chat to pass to his room. And then we did everyone, starting from staff and riders, a swab test, a rapid one, to be sure. And then I learned. They seen then João in the night, and then I learned this morning. He called the doctor. He was feeling not great, not super. It had been a cough, flu, and in the morning the doctor decided to do a rapid test, and was positive. After he did also a PCR, then we was waiting for the official one, confirmation. And on the same time, again, all the team had a test, and all the other, everyone, we are negative.
Do you imagine, well, it's easy to think that this affected him yesterday a little bit, although it wasn't a bad performance by any means yesterday.
Yeah, now it's easy to say yes. We was thinking it was just a bad day. He told us at the beginning of the climb, it was not great. Please, guys, support me as much you can. With Machine in the car, we scream all the climb going up with him. He was great until the end, suffering, just losing more second on the flat part going to the finish than on the climb. Yeah, at the end, it's easy to say, yeah, for sure, that was also the reason. But that is sport, cycling, that is the COVID, because of the last 2 years, COVID is not the first time that then affect the rider and stop from the performance.
And just finally, I guess you can tell us now, what was your plan for the last 4 days? What did you hope that you might still be able to get from this Giro?
No, he was really confident for the most on his endurance capacity. He was keeping every day not to be the best, not to be the stronger one, but never losing too much. That is his power. That we was confident on that. Then sooner or later, maybe the other can have a crack, can have a bad day. His power again is the constant to be there. Then and going for the TT last day.
Brian, well, we heard Fabio Baldato there talking about how Almeida's endurance is, I suppose, his superpower, and they still had high hopes for him possibly improving his position between now and Verona. Alas, that's not going to happen.
No, I've been very impressed by how he's been able to negotiate the setbacks or the many times he's been dropped out of a favorites group, because you need to really keep your head in the game when you see those guys drifting away whilst you're still entertaining hopes to be on the podium. And I think he's been really good at that, but at the same time, it has to be said that he wasn't one of the best riders in this race, and he was starting to look less and less of a threat, either for reasons that had to do with his shape, or as we know now, that he was, you know, probably at the verge of being sick with the COVID virus.
We also know now that, as well as being the acting American ambassador to Italy, Tom Smitham is the president of the João Almeida fan club, as he's just revealed off mic.
So not officially, but first of all, I'm very sad to hear of anybody who has to leave the race because of health reasons, and, you know, it's a reminder that COVID is still with us. But I was impressed with the way he's hung on in the last few days, where even when he was dropped, he made his way back and he kept the gaps, you know, to under a minute. So, you know, fourth position, he's still competitive. And I think that, you know, you don't know what's going to happen over the next 3 days, but he was obviously in the top five. And, you know, that's a competitive place to be in this Giro.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Giro d'Italia is supported by Science and Sport. Science and Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science and Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. Now, tomorrow is stage 19 of the Giro, and that brings to mind memories of the 2018 race when, on stage 19, Chris Froome launched an 80-kilometre brake, which contributed largely to Simon Yates cracking. Froome started the day 3 minutes 22 down on GC and eventually won the Giro d'Italia. And it was a significant day in the development of Science in Sport's beta fuel, because Team Sky's riders had tested it and trialled it in warm-up races and at training camps earlier in the year, but the Giro d'Italia was the first time that they had really used it in a major competition, and obviously the first time they'd used it in a Grand Tour. And the idea was that it would enable the riders to consume a lot more carbohydrate than they ordinarily would without having to eat a lot of solid food. So the carbohydrate intake was up, and that was particularly important during these back-to-back mountain stages, where James Morton, who was the nutritionist working with Science in Sport and Team Sky, estimated that the riders would burn between 4,000 and 6,000 calories on each of those mountain stages. And so carbohydrate would be really significant and vital source of fuel. And the beta fuel enabled the riders to consume that carbohydrate in a much more efficient way. Now, of course, beta fuel is available for everyone who rides a bike. And if you would like to get some, you can get 25% off at scienceinsport.com using the discount code SISCP25.
Well, Brian, we've got not just one, but two very important guests with us this evening at this point in the podcast, because we've moved from where we were having our select spritz to a very famous destination in Treviso. We've been here before, Le Beccherie in Treviso, which claims to be the inventor of tiramisu, as explored in the Cycling Podcast in great detail in 2018. And we're joined by Andrea, who works here. Andrea, what has happened in the world of tiramisu in the last 4 years? Cos'è successo? Cioè, l'ultima volta quando siamo stati qua c'era stata la Coppa del Mondo, c'era il conflitto con Tolmezzo, poi sappiamo che purtroppo è morto il signor Campeol. Quindi facci un breve riassunto degli ultimi 4 anni nel mondo del tiramisù.
Ok, in realtà no, nella sua consistenza non è cambiato nulla, nel senso che...
So in general nothing has really changed if we look at the fundamental things about tiramisù.
La ricetta originale è comunque stata codificata qui e nel tempo, in questi 4 anni, l'abbiamo, diciamo, un po' solidificata.
So we solidified that the original recipe for tiramisu stems from here.
E abbiamo però avuto la fortuna che in questi 4 anni è aumentato appunto la voglia di assaggiare il tiramisù e la sua ricetta originale che qui è nata.
And we've noticed,
grazie a noi, credo.
Magari.
So we've also, grazie anche a voi.
What Andrea is saying is that we've also noticed that in the past 4 years there's been a growing interest in coming to taste the tiramisù from where it originates.
Beh, come dicevo 4 anni fa, la forza del tiramisù è che comunque è un dolce povero, che lo si può fare in tutto il mondo, e la sua forza è questa.
So the strength of tiramisù is that it's a dessert for even for poor people. Anyone,
dolce del popolo.
Anyone anywhere can make tiramisù. It's the dessert of the people.
Mi dica una cosa, la guerra contro il Messico è finita?
La guerra contro il mezzo non è mai iniziata, nel senso che è stata una diatriba che comunque è nata per via di un nome, che era un nome dato a un dolce che era comunque differente da quello che è l'originalità.
So what Andrea is saying is
però giustamente glielo diamo, nel senso che è vero che aveva dato un nome.
He says it, at the heart of it is not a real conflict because there was a dessert by the same name, but the substance of the dessert served here and of which
la ricetta che tutti conoscono è nata qui, è stata codificata.
The tiramisu that everyone knows comes from here. The name had been used for another dessert from another place, so and that's why he's saying it's not a real conflict because the substance and the real ingredients of tiramisu are from right where we're sitting here.
We'll get back to the cycling, and we'll be tasting the tiramisu shortly. Grazie mille.
Grazie mille.
Grazie.
Grazie.
Well, Brian, I mean, we could talk for hours about tiramisu. It's too. We haven't got enough time to resume to. Sum up the whole, the long and quite fractious story of tiramisu, certainly when it comes to Treviso and Tolmezzo. We talked, didn't we, 4 years ago about how Tolmezzo had this receipt from 1953 that they were brandishing, and they were very upset about the Tiramisu World Cup because they said that Treviso took a busload of fans to support them, and consequently Treviso won. Brian, will this Giro d'Italia over the next few days, will it be as keenly fought as the Tiramisu World Cup? Because, well, as we said, things are pretty much unchanged in spite of the fact that Jai Hindley came in behind the main peloton today. He had a mechanical in the last 3 kilometres. And we've got this really mouth-watering battle, three-way battle between Landa, Hindley and Carapaz set up for the weekend.
Yeah, I have nothing bad to say about how potentially fantastic this last weekend could be. People really sometimes decry that there isn't, you know, the riders who are missing here, you know, why aren't, you know, there's some favorites who've, you know, gone home because of illness or crashes. But with the layout of the last part of the Giro, and especially the big stage in the Dolomites, which I'm looking forward to in a very, very big way, I expect that to be a big race. I can't really see what the issue is with this race being boring, because we can talk about that in Verona. But this, being this close at this point in the race, like find a cycling fan that's not going to watch the stage on Saturday.
Do you know what we should do tomorrow, Brian? We should come up with a list of sort of top 10 of the closest Grand Tours ever. There have been a lot in the last few years. It was quite rare until very recently for Grand Tours to be decided by fewer than 20 seconds, but it's become more common. Brian, Jai Hindley is a really intriguing ingredient in this battle for the top three, or battle for the Maglia Rosa. Of course, he came very close 2 years ago, and I suppose he's the surprise, although there was that precedent, partly because he's had a difficult 18 months or so. This morning in Borgo Valsugana, I spoke to his coach, Hendrik Werner, about how surprised, how delighted Bora Hansgrohe are with Jai Hindley and how confident they are going into this weekend.
So Hendrik, this is your first year working with Jai Hindley, and it's obviously going really, really well so far after a difficult year for him last year. But tell me about your first impressions of him, particularly as an athlete, but also as a human being.
Actually, I have to say, in Sunweb, I already worked with him 2 years, and so I was not his responsible coach there, but I spent altitude tech camps, and for sure, I knew where I'm at and who I get to work with. But I think now I even realize a bit more layers of his personality here in the Giro as well, and that's pretty exciting.
And as an athlete, what do you see as his main sort of superpowers? I mean, he's obviously an amazing climber, and that's down to power to weight ratio, but sort of digging a little bit deeper in terms of, I don't know, whether it's lactate tolerance, or what are his main strengths as an athlete, as a sort of physiologically speaking?
Yeah, I would say, like, also back in the days already, like we did all the testings and critical power testings, and he wasn't in particular the guy who always was shining there at the top, like the outstanding, let's say, 3 or 4 minutes comparison to all the others. But there was such a resistance to fatigue, and I also when you look back in the days how he developed over the course of time, and how much he was even developing during that race, that I also said, like, maybe if you get his number and you just purely look on, oh, that's a 3 minute, that's a 10 minute, for sure they are outstanding, but they are not like, oh, you don't get this from anyone else. But the fatigue resistance and the how much and how often he can do it repeatedly, I think that's something outstanding. And then if you look on how he's developing, also what we see here, that's probably also one of the factors why we signed him, why we had so much trust in him.
And on long climbs as well, I mean, Jens Zemke said to me the other day that in this week we would get slightly longer climbs, so I guess over sort of 30, 40, 50 minutes as well, he's pretty outstanding.
Obviously, yeah. I would say, like, the punchy stuff, probably you would first thought that he lacks a bit there, but also we worked on it this winter and put some intensities in there, and I think also we see it back now with the sprints. To be honest, I'm also a bit surprised, but I think it's also because he has quite something over in the tank that he does sprints like he do. But on longer climbs, I've no doubt he looks so stable, and also he had quite a good winter. Yes, I have to be honest, that after Liège there was a massive setback, and it was already a big success to bring him here healthy. That was already halfway then, because it was really quite some question marks behind it. But now I think all the question marks subsided.
And when he did join in the winter, was there any big change that you tried to implement, or was it just a question of getting back to where he had been in 2020 and following a similar formula to the one he'd probably followed then?
Yeah, I think when I had the first talks with him, because I also talked to his recent trainer and asked him what he learned and what probably didn't work, the biggest fuck-ups or whatever, but also it was quite a good mix with him and his old trainer. So actually I reached out, and
who is that, Hendrik?
That was Dio Zonders, and he also valued him really much, but I also wanted to learn from this experience. And we also said, like, I mean, everyone has strengths and weaknesses, and you can focus on the weaknesses, but they always come also with a price, and you also have to be willing to pay this. And I thought, like, I think it's more wise to strengthen strengths than to strengthen weaknesses and pay the price. So we basically went back to his strengths and for the long climbs to also strengthen this even more, and putting some sparks also for his dynamics of sprints, but not going too crazy for the weaknesses. And I think it pays out pretty well. Yeah,
I guess some might say that, as is the case for most climbers, time trialing has been a bit of a weakness for him. Where are you at in terms of the testing he's done, the work he's done on his time trialing, and obviously how confident you are about Sunday?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it was especially in really fast time trials and connecting, let's say, the power to the kinetics. So putting power in that special position, but much more combined with high speed. And honestly, if I also look on Sunday, he did, to my understanding, and also from where we came from the time before, already good starting time trial. It was not crazy, but for the circumstances and the context, it was already promising. And we put quite some work in there and also tried to work on this, combined with the speed. On Sunday, I think it's a bit different kind of thing. So first of all, we have the fatigue creeping into the legs of all the contenders, in his legs as well. But I think he's dealing pretty well at the moment. Next to that, you have pretty technical part, and he's pretty good in cornering and in handling his bike. But you also have a massive part in this uphill part. And I think this also plays into his favor. I have to be honest that for sure Carapaz is a really good time trialist, and he has a lot of experience how to do it also in a Grand Tour. And also if you look to Landa, he also did quite a good time trial. So I think it will be super exciting. I wouldn't necessarily say this one is much, much better than the others. I think it's pretty balanced. But honestly, how I saw him moving on the bike, his confidence, and also that he put some work in there, and looking on the profile, I'm not afraid of that.
And very last thing, Hendrik, in your heart, are you confident about the next 3 days, but particularly the mountain stages, because we've seen they're so even, these guys, or they seem to be. But what we don't know is whether one of them has something left that they haven't quite shown, and they will show over the next couple of days. Are you confident?
Yes, I am. But honestly, it's not a saying. It's really, really big. I mean, there's quite some ease and a pretty easy approach also within the team, and I think we managed pretty well to keep this. And if we just keep on the things we're doing anyway already for 2.5 weeks and just staying in this routine and also seeing how he was moving on the bike, I mean, you can never plan how the next days plan out, but the intention is clear, the confidence is there, and all the rest, that's also not up to us. So our attitude is, that's clear. And let's see.
Well, Brian, Tom, I don't know about you guys, but I thought Hendrik Verne sounded pretty confident there, but Carapaz looks very confident as well, doesn't he? I'm intrigued by this comment that he made yesterday, that he doesn't think tomorrow, with this very difficult penultimate climb in Slovenia, he doesn't think it's going to make much difference to proceedings. But at this point, who do we think is going to win this Giro? Tom?
So I'm a student of the Cycling Podcast enough to know that the Cycling Podcast does not make predictions. So I'm going to be neutral on that part. What I think is interesting is how close it is. And I mean, I remember when Ryder Heggedal won, in 2012. And, you correct me on the year, but when Menchov, kind of fell down in the final time trial in probably 2009. So it makes for a very exciting race. And the fact that the top two are separated by 3 seconds, and anything could happen to those two, and then you've got, you've got Landa, and, don't forget Nibali, 5 minutes down behind. So I'm going to let you guys make the predictions, and I'm going to stay neutral.
Well, the Dolomites are approaching. Tomorrow we're not in the Dolomites, but we certainly will be on Saturday, and that is the stage I think everyone agrees, is the one that is most eagerly anticipated, both for the setting, the grandiose mountain setting that we'll have that day, and also for what's still to be decided in terms of the race. Now, the Dolomites were somewhere that our beloved friend Richard Moore loved to visit every year. It was generally Richard who did the northern swing of the Giro with me, so we did the Dolomite stages together on numerous occasions. I was going to save this clip for tomorrow, when we will be just on the eve of the big Dolomite stage, but sort of in honour of the fact that Richard didn't have much time for us talking about tiramisu in 2018 and wanted to sort of move hastily onto other things more related to the race. Tonight's Giro del Buffalo is going to be the Buffalo in the Grand Tour Diaries, or for the Grand Tour Diaries that we published as a book in 2018 and later as an audio book, talking about the Dolomites.
Il Giro del Buffalo, remembering Richard Moore.
Thursday, the 25th of May, stage 18, Moena de Ortizai Santulrich, 137 kilometres. Stage winner, TJ Van Garderen. Pink jersey, Tom Dumoulin. Hands down, this is the most beautiful stage I've ever driven in a Grand Tour. We set off through Canetzai, where yesterday's stage finished, and then begin at a point I can't really determine, to climb the Pordoi Pass, winding up through the trees, emerging on a plateau and stopping at a restaurant that stands there all alone. It's magical, the light, the colours, the sense of being somewhere other. The Alps might be like this if there were no people and it wasn't so overdeveloped, but it still wouldn't be as lovely on the eye, and it's difficult to imagine the air being as pure. I was first over the summit there 5 times, said Faust, a copy of the Pordoi Pass, maybe because whenever I was in that area, I could breathe beautifully. The road itself, transporting us through pine forest to this point, is sheer pleasure. 27 hairpins over 11.8 kilometres to an elevation of 2,239 metres. It's not ridiculously steep, at most 8%, making it enjoyable to drive, and I can sort of easily imagine cycle. At the restaurant, there's one other vehicle in the car park, the gleaming white Skoda of L'Equipe, with that familiar logo, tall, red, gently slanting capital letters emblazoned on the side. It is, as Daniel notes, one of the great brands. But something else struck me as we approached the car park and spotted the L'Equipe car sitting there all alone. The timelessness of this image. I could imagine the L'Equipe car stopped here during a 1960s Giro, its journalists and their driver inside the cafe, sipping their coffee and smoking their Galois. That's something else that hasn't changed about L'Equipe. They still have a driver to ferry the writers and keep the car looking immaculate. The journalists here are Gilles Simon, the cycling editor, and Philippe Brunel with his shoulder-length black hair, who wears the same outfit every day, skinny black jeans and tight black t-shirt, sometimes with a black pullover slung around his neck, as is compulsory for Frenchmen of a certain age. He is 61, but could be in his mid-40s. He's been writing about cycling for 38 years. Today, the three of them sit at an outside table with their driver, drinking coffee, not smoking, but doing something almost as bad for a Frenchman's health, discussing the prospects of Thibaut Pinot.
Well, it brings back memories hearing Richard's voice. I remember distinctly meeting him and you last year. And it's one of these strange things where if you see social media and you've heard about Richard, it's amazing the effect he's had on people, even on those he's met in a short time. And that was the way it was for me and my wife after just meeting him. And we're all very, very sorry that he's passed and wanted to extend our best wishes to him, to his family, for his passing.
Thank you, Tom. Well, chaps, Richard would not approve of us spending more time talking about tiramisu this evening, but I'm afraid our tiramisu has arrived. It's a very unusual time of day to eat tiramisu, certainly as far as I'm concerned. Never mind 11 o'clock cappuccinos, it's 8 o'clock and we're about to tuck in. Brian, first impressions. Tom, first impressions.
Well, I mean, it's a bit like MasterChef, only we know who actually won, because these are the champions, the creators and the champions of tiramisu.
Extraordinary stuff, extraordinary stuff.
I think in honor of Richard Moore, I'm going to declare it nice.
Doesn't get any better than that.
That's a very convenient last word. But Tom, I will just ask you, you've spent quite a significant amount of time in Italy now, and this whole polemica about the tiramisu is very reflective, it's very sort of symptomatic of a lot of things in Italian life, and a lot of things we love about the Italians, isn't it?
Well, I follow that mostly on the politics side, and that's what makes politics here interesting, because there's a dispute every day, and, you know, hopefully Italians work through their disputes through the political process, but it makes it interesting for an outside observer to see. And yes, you see this reflected also in the food and in the football teams.
Well, it's been a privilege to have you with us, Tom, and I suggest we go out this evening, we sign out with a toast to the Campeol family, Aldo and Alba, who sadly passed away a few months ago, and to our great friend Richard Moore.
Salute.
Grazie.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.